Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of Lowdown. Today I'm absolutely delighted to be joined by Michael Beale. Michael, big warm welcome to the show.
Hi, Cutter. Pleasure to come on, mate.
Michael, as we begin with every guest that comes on the show, could you please take us through your earliest football memory?
Yeah, I was going to Wembley to watch Chelsea Man City in 1986 in a cup final with my dad, his best friend, and his lad Thomas. So that was like my first football memory. And same year, obviously, it was the World Cup, Maradona in England, and everything that went with that. So my family's follow Chelsea, so it was a different Chelsea back then to the one we saw today. But boys like David Speedy were playing, and Kerry Dixon, and things like that. So that's my earliest memory. I actually started playing for a team called Vista in South London. It was 11-a-side back then when I was six, but it was an under-9s team. My dad registered me. Lost our first game 6-1, but it improved after that, Con, to be fair. And yeah, they're my earliest memories, mate.
And I mean, how soon, I suppose, growing up? I mean, obviously, you had a bit of a playing career. We're speaking off camera. I mean, you were in England, you were in Holland, you were in the US. How soon in your own footballing journey did you realize, Michael, this is going to be a vocation and this is going to be a profession?
Well, I was playing for a very. I moved Sunday League clubs to a team called Valley Valiants, which was quite a successful team in South London. We had Scott Parker played in that team as well. Gary O'Neill played in the team a couple of years below. So, obviously, two names that have gone on. But at the time, in that age group, we had 11 or 12 players that were signed at Cholton as well, because obviously it was schoolboys back then. You trained in the week for your professional club, and you obviously played for your grassroots team at the weekend. And I was just hooked, really, from then. And I stayed at Charlton up until the reserve team. And there were some reasons why maybe it didn't progress for me beyond the reserve team level. I think in that window, you have a moment in time where you really got to grasp it. And for whatever reason, it didn't work out for me. But then when I come out of the game, it was like, how am I going to stay in football? Because it's the biggest passion I had. You know, everything at school was focused around getting to play time to play football and play for your school team, grassroots, county, district. Then you play for your pro club. It's everything that you wanted to do. And so going into coaching and going into futsal coaching, or at the time it was called Brazilian Soccer Schools, run by Simon Clifford, it was about the individual, you know, in a hall with a hard flooring, a small ball, lots of touches on the ball. It was everything that I loved about playing football. You know, I was a wide player, a dribbler. So I loved that type of coaching. And once I started coaching, I got a massive energy for that, working with the individual, really, more so than the team. And then I thought there's no better way to work, really, working with young kids to help them try and fulfill their dreams. What I wanted them to do as well is not have the same feelings that I had when I was coming out of the game, because there was a lot of hurt and frustration coming out at 20, 21. You wanted to really give an enjoyment back to young kids. And that's took me on an amazing journey, kind of from that point, you know, just starting that soccer school to where it's taken me today. I always think back to that time as well and try not to get too far ahead of myself in terms of what's happening, you know, inside the professional game, because I just remember back to when I first started and what I was trying to achieve, really.
It's quite amazing too. Like you hear of many people beginning their own football coaching journey, and it's a case of coaching the younger brothers, grassroots team, coaching Sunday League, very humble beginnings. But in fact, jumping in straight away to having your own futsal school, and that's in fact where you became acquainted at the time with Neil Batt, Chelsea's then academy director.
Yeah, well, I was probably doing about 6 or 7 months, and I see that I've got an interesting story about this for young coaches, because at the time I was a young player, I wasn't confident to speak for myself. And I've always tried to now make my players quite confident in terms of talking about their ambitions and their strengths. And I remember I got offered, there was a job interview up at Fulham and Chelsea to work in development centres or the young academy age groups. And I went to Fulham on the Tuesday, I think, and Paul Clement was in charge then at Fulham, who's obviously gone on to work at Chelsea and Real Madrid and whatnot with Carlo Ancelotti. And then Damian Matthew did my interview on the Wednesday, but I've always been a Chelsea fan. So when Paul rang me back, I actually didn't return his call because I accepted the job at Chelsea. And you can imagine that was back in 2003. And In 2007, my first day full-time at Chelsea, because I did 4 years part-time, it was the first day full-time for Paul Clements, for the under-18s coach as well. So he never mentioned it. Hopefully he forgot it. But that just shows you, when you're young, you know, I didn't have the personal skills to just tell Paul, thanks, but no thanks, I want to go to Chelsea. Like, you, these things, like, you, I always try to tell that story because it's important that you grow these social skills as well. I was quite a muted young player at 19, 20. And, yeah, so I did three or four years at Chelsea part-time, working in development centres with the 6, 7, 8-year-olds, working with the under-9s and under-10s before I went full-time as youth development officer in 2007. It was Damien Matthew that got me in, first of all, who was the youth development officer. And it's been interesting in my first two jobs as manager. Damien was my assistant manager, so our relationship went back to then. And so, yeah, the Chelsea Academy, I've seen grow from pre-Abramovich to the Abramovich era and everything that it's become now today.
Interesting, just to hark back to that. I mean, behind every technical or soft skill for me, you know, there's an anecdotal story about it. And you know, if we were to speak about skills, I remember, you know, as we discussed off air, I first came across yourself, listening to you in Saul Isaacson's podcast, I believe it was in 2017 now. And you spoke at the time about being a coach, seeing the game as, you know, the game as a series of 1v1s, 2v1s, tactics are overrated. And fast forward all these years later, obviously, with so many first team coaching positions underneath your belt, you even more strongly adhere to that statement.
Yeah, 100%. I think, look, my biggest job is to try and make someone comfortable in the environment. That again goes back to, you know, whether it's a trialist coming into your group or a player being signed to the club, it's still at first team. Can you make someone comfortable? And I love players to have freedom, and everything's around this outplaying. Like, you know, the 11-a-side game is quite easy to coach. It's breaking down the small technical bits, the 1v1s, 2v1s, 3v2s, the little execution in those moments, because that's actually when you watch the game, you look at a 20-by-20-yard area, that's actually what's going on. And so that's, you know, it takes me back to youth coaching. A lot of the practices we still use at first team, the 2v2s, 3v2s, are still practices you can use with under-10s, 11s, 12s. You're just obviously looking for faster execution and better decision-making. At the younger ages, you're teaching the fundamentals of what to see and the options the players have. That's the beauty of coaching. That's that real freedom that you have inside when you're coaching. You know, there's not another thought in the world. Players talk about it, when they're playing, they're free. And when you're coaching, you feel that as well. I love to have players, three or four in the team, that have got license to break the rules. Of course, you have to have structure. You have to have a number of your players that, you know, we talk about positional play now, but I still think the best players are the ones that the coaches give a little bit more to break the rules. And all of the best players, that, or the players I've enjoyed working with the most, are the ones that I've given that license to. And they bring their own personality into your team. And I think that's so important. And again, each coach has something different they really focus on. There's certain elements you've got to have to get in a football club: technical ability, tactical awareness, the athletic attributes to play the position that you're being asked to play, the fact that you're durable, you have to be durable, fit, around the season, the elite mentality. They're like five basic fundamentals that you have to have. But then each coach has some things they like. And I like the action man hips, the ability to twist and turn, like the old action men we have with kids when the hips go round. And I like players that can outplay 1v1. I like players who are a little bit cheeky at times, you know, a little bit. I've got a personality that you've got to manage. I much rather with personalities need to turn it down than have to try and turn someone's personality up. And so all those little things, I've just added layers to it. But all the players I really enjoyed coaching on the journey and enjoy watching on TV, I've got that little bit of maverick about them. And I think that's something that as coaches, we really need to make sure we maintain for all of our practices, all of us now doing PowerPoints about our philosophies, all of us watching the top coaches at the top level. It's okay, but how do you get a player on that pitch? It's a different type of coaching. When you watch a Man City and you watch how polished they are in terms of their positional play, you still come back to a Bernardo Silva that does something different. You still come back to Phil Foden. And so do we know how to develop a player to play at that level, or are we just copying the coach at that level? Hopefully I'm articulating that right. It's different.
Of course. And do you think like we're in real danger? Suppose this is not even related to the UK, but in terms of worldwide and youth development, you know, there's evidently, I mean, as coaches, we see there's a plight in the terms of the amount of Mavericks coming through the system. I mean, do you think the way things are currently progressing, do you think there's enough being done to encourage that Maverick to still develop? Do you think we're doing enough to organically grow and develop such players?
Well, coach education's come on so far. And I wonder sometimes now we have head of coachings that come and watch the coaches coach, and we talk about fancy words like interventions and this, that, and the other. And it's all coaching jargon. It means nothing to the young kids that you're coaching. I'm wondering if we've gone a little bit too far. Just because you've got a coach on your back, you know, in terms of your jacket you're wearing, doesn't mean you have to coach every minute of every day. I go back to, you know, a lot of the days of years gone past, it was 80% playing and 20% structure, because you only went into your clubs 1 or 2 days a week. Now, from the age of 6, players go into academies 6, 7, and 8, and it's definitely 80 or 90% coaching and 10% play. There's no play outside. So for me, we have to get that balance right. Just because in the academy we've got to put on a certain amount of hours a week, do we have to be coaching every minute of that? You know, is there a way that we can focus more on the individual and stuff? I think coaching, and I think being a football coach and a developer is a way of life. It's not a profession. It's something that you're doing every minute of every day. And it's much easier to keep your own house in order in the club you're in than try and solve the problems of all the clubs in the world. You know, like, so I think within your environment and your club, maybe it's saying that you need to monitor how much is the ball rolling in terms of play, because the game gives you so much. And also we have to remind ourselves that peer learning, when you're young, you're envious is probably not the right word, but you're very aware of somebody else if they've got a particular skill that you would like to have. And that's where practice comes from, and competition and grit and desire to get better comes from as well. You know, so peer learning is massive. And I think possibly now we got a lot of young Guardiolas or young Mourinhos or young Ancelottis working with 9, 10, 11-year-olds. And we've got to be careful with that. And what I mean by that is they're coaching what they're seeing on TV and not the diet that that 9, 10, 11-year-old needs. And so for me, the game of 1v1s or 2v1, 3v2 is enough, probably up to under 12 or 13. I think if you can really execute the confidence to play in those battles in and out of possession, then you'll end up with a really good team. The academy manager at Liverpool used to say to me, Mick, what would you like to receive? Like 11 technically brilliant players or 11 tactically brilliant players? Well, you'd always want the technical one. So we always have to be aware of what we're handing over to the next. And there's a few really good practitioners out there working in the academy. Alex is one, Chris Ramsey's another, that haven't veered too far from that model.
It's really interesting because, you know, as you speak there, I think, you know, back to how important one's coaching journey is, but how important being intentional about one's coaching journey is. And obviously, you spent up to 15 years at places such as Chelsea and Liverpool. But for me, it's interesting when you mention names such as Chris Ramsey and other coaches. It's like, if you look over time at Chelsea and Liverpool, the likes of people you worked with, such as your Steve Clarence, Brendan Rodgers, Old Clements, Liverpool, Steven Gerrard, Pep Yinders at the youth level. There's so much diversity of thought and experience. How influential was that to you in shaping your own coaching methodology over time?
Yeah, as a young Chelsea fan going in there at the time, Ranieri was manager, then Mourinho came, and it was like, wow, he said he was a special one, he was going to win the league, and he did. And everyone was like, wow, he was different. And you see the different ways of the way that you were, Ancelotti, hitting, these were like the gods of coaching. I weren't close to any of them, but Neil Barker was brilliant at letting us go over and watch. And then through the academy, we had Paul Clement, we had Steve Clarke, obviously the current Scottish manager, we had Steve Holland, assistant manager now with England, we had Dermot Drummey, we had some fantastic coaches coming through the academy. Joe Edwards has just been manager at Millwall and assistant at Everton. Go to Liverpool, there's Brendan Rodgers. Obviously, there was Alex Ingvall. Steve Cooper was there as well. Neil Critchley, manager of Blackpool, and his assistant, Mike Garrity. I helped to recruit Pepin Linders, who was a good friend of mine. So all of these people being around you, like the energy coming off you every day. I always say that in your building, if the conversations are good about football, the level of the conversation goes on the park. And that's so true, like in terms of the people that you work with, the level of conversation you're having day in, day out. It does go out on the grass to the players. And I think it's nice to have long conversations in the office over a tea and biscuit in the afternoon. Like, you'd never want to go home when you was at Chelsea or Liverpool because you felt you was learning a lot. The biggest learner as well is the players, because players come along and they push your boundaries of what's possible with a player in that age group. So I'm more thankful to the players that I've worked with and the environments that Chelsea and Liverpool gave me when I was growing. And again, the experience in South America, albeit it was only 6.5 months, that's had like a profound in terms of my confidence, in terms of my belief, even more drilling down into the values and the ideas that I had for player development. It's only strengthened those from what I saw in South America.
It was an interesting consideration made earlier on about the point of having 11 tactical players over 11 tactical players. And obviously, you can reflect back at your time in Chelsea and indeed Liverpool and look at, there was multiple golden generations there. And, you know, in hindsight, it may be a little bit easier to reflect and look back and connect the dots. But were there any telltale signs, I mean, even from a technical level, where you're looking back at these players and said, yeah, we always knew from day one they're going to make it, and then we have to mobilise resources accordingly?
Yeah, but you're always thinking, why might a player fail? You know, because they've got so many attributes. They come in, they, you know, at Chelsea and Liverpool, they've already beaten off a lot of competition to get where they are. And we always talk about, you know, who's in our group today, what do they need, you know, rather than what's the theme of the session. Like, who's in my group today? What do I need? What do they need to help them? What might make them foul? And go back to like one of my first groups at under nine, Ruben Loftus-Cheek was in there, and he was already just an unbelievable, he had unbelievable movement mechanics. I'm not going to say he's an unbelievable athlete because he was nine. So he was going to go through his growth, and he had a difficult period of growth. But Ruben, I knew straight away, just had movement mechanics that when you were teaching him a lot of curver or individual moves, they sort of stuck with him. These movement mechanics were outstanding compared to the other kids I was seeing at Chelsea, other kids I was seeing in the other academies that we were playing. And all of the ones that I've worked with, sorry, have all had this huge natural enthusiasm for football. Just a huge natural enthusiasm to turn up, to train, to want to get better. And have made the ones that have always excited me are the ones that have made small improvements all the time. So Mason Mount, Declan Rice, Dom Solanke. Speaking about one at the moment, because it's quite topical, is Mark Guey. Mark's not got the same technical level as someone like young Jeremy Boga had when I first started working with him. But Mark's natural enthusiasm for training and learning and growing. And these boys have to work out what their own super strengths are and what their own football personality is as they go through the age groups. And I think at the start, you're giving them this real technical hard drive. And then once you come out of that, it's what's stuck. You know, what do they love about the game? So Mark loved defending. He loved 1v1 defending. So you'd put him up against Tammy one day, Rian Brewster the next, Dom Solanke the next. And that's how you develop them. But the best ones have got a huge natural enthusiasm, you know, to just keep going, because it's not easy. You know, like, people look at, say, Trent Alexander, the way that he's gone on at Liverpool, and his journey wasn't as linear as people make out. And that's the thing. Like, people talk about putting trauma in a player's development. I'm not so sure about that. I've heard that spoken about a lot, even in clubs I've been in. But I think through life and football, it comes at you. For example, like, Trent's age group at Liverpool wasn't a good age group, and he would play sometimes and they would get beat 4 or 5-1. And Liverpool's job, we at the academy there, was different to one or two of the other big academies. They didn't just recruit for age groups. They would never block a player on his journey. So they had no real interest in bringing 5 or 6 players into the group Trent was in. It was about obviously developing Trent or one or two others on to get where they are. And they're all different, and it's hard to pick one you coached that was your favourite, but the natural enthusiasm for football and just their ability to learn and want to get better sticks out for all of them. And, you know, people lose that in different ways and say it's dedication and work ethic, and he was always going to be a player. I'm not sure about that. I think there was a lot of good handling along the way. And then you get to see him at different levels. You take him into Europe to play tournaments. You push him up an age group. You train him first, see how they handle it. You know, I remember Neil Critchley doing a practice with Alex Inglethorpe and Trent where he got four or five wide players in a line taking him on, really trying to improve his individual defending. And that would have been Harry Wilson, Shea Ojo, Ryan Kent, Sergi Canos, players that have gone on themselves to be top players. And just putting them on a carousel just to get at Trent and mentally make it tough for him. So the coaches put a lot in, but the boys that have got that natural enthusiasm. And obviously, you then have a great responsibility to make sure that your level of your session and the energy you bring matches theirs as well.
Fantastic. And obviously, like, the step to Brazil was not only a huge one professionally, but also personally. But I mean, if we're to focus just right now in the youth development scene there alone, I mean, how similar or contrasting was, I suppose, the ecosystem for player development? I mean, you look at, you know, we speak about regions in which the most amount of professional footballers come from, you know, two at the very top are both South London and Sao Paulo, but you have great experiences of both. I mean, how similar or contrasting are both those environments conducive for player development?
Well, obviously, I went there as assistant manager, but they've got an unbelievable academy, one of the best in the world, called Cotia. Produced so many top players for the Brazil national team and teams around Europe. So I went there to watch. One of the first games I watched, Éder Militão was playing in, the Real Madrid player, and we brought him to the first team with seven or other players from that group. The coach of that B team is now the coach of Club Americas in Mexico. He's just won three or four trophies this year, but he was the Brazil under-23 coach as well, André Jardim. And so he's gone on to do really well. What I noticed straight away is they weren't as ate up with practices as we are in Europe, and certainly as we are in UK, in the UK. You know, the practice design and the practice this and practice that. Their coaching was much more loose and based around the game. Like, it was much more of, you know, being game effective. My first thing, and I was sending emails back to people that, you know, I was sharing ideas with here in the UK, John McDermott being one at Spurs and Alex Inglethorpe at Liverpool, about the similarities and the cultural differences. And I was always comparing our young players I just worked with at Chelsea and Liverpool to the players that were over there in Brazil. And I was really excited by that I felt our players were technically as good. And as I say, I mentioned at the time that I felt the coaching was a bit looser than ours, but maybe there's something in that. Remember the comment I made a minute ago about, you know, now we've got so many coaches and we're all qualified and we've all got big aspirations. Do we coach every minute of the day? Do we coach too much? Do we facilitate enough? You know, are we good at facilitating the boys playing the game? And fascinating, like, it's a complete different culture. So, you know, everything they're doing is about outplaying someone and trying to create and score goals. And even the way they defend is linked to it as well. So they see.
And we were just speaking there, Michael, about the Brazilians being able to outplay, that the structure of the train is a lot more loose, being able to facilitate it towards the players.
Yeah, like, you know, the emphasis is obviously about the it's like a personal pride individual technique, like a level above the personal pride we have here in the UK. And like, the everything's set up to, like, create and score goals. You know, the unbelievable celebrations the commentators make, maybe that's the reason behind it. You'd always want to be a player that scored a goal with that sort of what I saw was, it's very naturally creative. Their combination play and their creativity is at a level that is higher than in Europe, in my opinion. Even I was over in December just past, visiting my friends working at Bahia now, Rogério Ceni and Charles Hembo, and just watching them play their five and seven asides, it brought back so many fond memories for those days in Sao Paulo. It's the culture's about creating and scoring, even the way that you defend. And I remember we'd done all the pre-season in Florida, come back in Sao Paulo, getting ready for the first game. And the day before the first game, Poggiero was like, look, at the end, I'm just going to give them 10 minutes. And like their goalie can play out on field. They can do whatever they want. They can play a half field game. And being the European, I got in a bit of a huff and was like, why are we doing this? Like everything's been structured. I went and sat on the side and watched it. And it was the best game I ever see. Like the skill and the creativity and the technique of the players, but the enjoyment like that they had at a professional level of like, and it wasn't loose. It was still competitive. It was just like an outrageous game in terms of like technique, and the goalie come out and played in the middle of the pitch and he was absolutely incredible. And so you learn all these things, and it brought back a lot of the beliefs that I had obviously in coaching in academies about 1v1 and outplaying and the use of the second player. I only have to see him. I don't have to use him. So if it's me and a friend against you, sometimes like faking to use him, using his movement, I don't actually physically have to use him by passing to him. If I do, what do I do next? And all of those little bits around the game, and it must come back from the street football. They don't have the same structure that we have. They don't have the same opportunities in life. They need to be a football player, where I certainly think that's some cases around Europe and around the world where players need to be. But in general, you want to be a player. And if not, there's a lot of other opportunities for you in life. And I think in some parts of the world, and certainly in some parts of South America, the need to be a player is also a big driving factor over, you know, some people in around the world that have got maybe more opportunities, you know?
And that's an interesting point and caveat to make about the need. What about the experience in Brazil? And this is off topic, not professional, but personally, how did that shape you as a person?
Well, you're playing at times in extreme heat and also not on the best of pitches. So can you go and press in that heat like you do in European teams? So it makes you much more about the awareness of space and the cohesion of your team moving around the pitch. Also in Brazil, they have a big love for number 10s or Mavericks that, if you like, don't do as much for the team out of possession as we like maybe in the UK, where everyone mucks in and does a bit of everything. So how do you manage that? You know, how do you manage that to get the best out of this player? You know, it's still a part of the world where the best number 10s come from. You know, if you look at the best teams around Europe, the South American players, they bring a flavor that the European players don't bring. Same as with the African players. Without stereotyping, players in different parts of the world bring a different thing. So that was important for me, playing against low blocks and things like that. And again, in that heat, how you move them, how you have to give the creativity over to your main players to open those blocks. You know, in Europe, it's a fast game, fast pitches. We used to talk about that at Liverpool. We used to make our pitches cut so low, so much water in them. There was a fast pitch. That's how we wanted to play football. When you go to away from home in South America and the grass is kept long for an obvious reason, there's no water on the pitch and there's still a low block, then it's much more like, how do you get in certain areas? And you give these players the freedom, but also their relationships. So like the connection between me and you. So that might be like a wide player and a forward, a number 10, a number 9. And it's fascinating, you know, to learn. So in South America, yes, I did share a lot because they're fascinated by Europe. But also I did a lot of learning in terms of watching, learning, listening. I was lucky enough to see when they were young, a lot of players that have now moved into Europe and been big players from Brazil. I see them when they were young. And that was a pleasure for me to see as well, that, you know, for example, players like Douglas Luiz, who then went on to work with at Aston Villa, was at Vasco. He was a great player. He's changed quite a bit from the boy that came through at Vasco to the boy that's playing in the Premier League now, and obviously just gone to Juventus. But, you know, you saw him at the beginning, and you see now he's added to his game. Richarlison's another one. Eder Militao, obviously, we spoke about. Rodrigo was just about to make his breakthrough at Santos at the same time. So you see how they change coming to Europe. They keep some of the fundamental attributes they had in Brazil, but it's a different game. And I think we see that flavour when it comes to the World Cup, for sure.
And it's very interesting to move back to England after 6.5 months, taking up essentially I had a coaching position within the Liverpool Academy for 8 months before the phone call rang from Steven Gerrard to join them at Rangers.
Yeah, when I left to go to Brazil, it coincided with Steven coming back into work with the 18, so our paths never crossed at all. And I came back and I had a couple of opportunities to be a manager in League One or League Two. And it was Alex Inglethorpe, my good friend, who spoke me out of it and said, you know, why don't you just come back into the academy, bring back these ideas that you've got that obviously I've been sharing with him. He could feel the energy I had. And it was the best advice anyone's ever given me. I was back working in Liverpool, helping oversee the under sevens through to the under 12s, and went on a massive thing about receiving, moving, releasing the ball, like receiving being fundamental, how you receive it, different parts of your foot. Then are you moving with the ball or are you releasing it, and trying to link the three, playing lots of small sided games, doing lots of skill sets in training. It was like I'd gone back 10 years to that coach that started out at Chelsea, but obviously with more meat on the bone to my ideas, more confidence because of what I'd seen at first team level. I took the coaches of the 9s, 10s, 11s across the Holland. We went to visit three or four clubs so that we could see that the program that we were using was is it really exciting? So they come back with more energy. It was a fantastic period from September through to the end of the season. At the end of the season come, and obviously it was in the media that Stephen was taking the Rangers job, and it was probably the first time we got past hello and had a proper conversation. And as obviously Stephen's a really impressive person, and he asked me to go and work with him. And after working with an icon like Rogério Ceni in Brazil, it was another opportunity at another huge football club, and at a time when we were very much the underdog. So I accepted that, but the energy that I had for the youth development has never gone away. Obviously, you get pulled towards first team, but the passion and the sort of the work I have with those young players at Liverpool, and you're slowly starting to see those group of players now coming through at Liverpool. So it's lovely to see. Like you, that I left there in 2018. So that group of players now, 6 years later, that was like your under 11s. They're now the youth team. So it's fantastic. You know, when I go and watch these little boys grow up now, it's great to see big memories from that time.
And speaking off camera, you mentioned like you just found there was like a complete freedom in your coaching during that period, kind of having that open enough position to bring back and implement and experiment with new ideas. Do you think like it's crucial for a coach in his or her development to kind of take that time where it's kind of free time, going abroad, obtaining new experiences, being able to come back and be able to experiment, improve and develop oneself?
Yeah, it's very hard at first team level to experiment at times because you know that every result is crucial to everybody, the fans, the club and the players and all the staff is important. But certainly when I came back from that experience and the period when I left Rangers last year was a period for me both times to go and see and remind myself what's out there in the world and experience and experiment again, because sometimes you're stuck in a bubble of your football club and therefore it's important. You can be very fortunate at times that you've got the right people and the right learning around you. Other times the schedule is king, and the schedule of playing every 3 days and training and managing means that you're very much focused in that bubble of where you're working. So coming back and having that period after Brazil to implement some ideas at youth development was massive. A lot of the work that we did was like one night a week, the 9s to 12s all trained together and mixed up, and it was just a ball and a player on different techniques of moving, receiving and releasing the ball. And then there was a lot of street games going on, a lot of entry games, a lot of fun, a lot of expression. And the other 2 days they went back to their own age groups. I thought that was really important for peer learning. And then I went back to Brazil in December for the first time in 6 years, just to go back and feel it again, you know, feel it, smell it, see what the football was like again there. And spent a bit of time in Belgium and France as well doing the same. I plan now in this break to I've been fascinated by Japan, so I'm going to go across to the J League. I've got a lot of friends in the US, in the MLS, that I haven't been able to see in a number of years, so I'm going to get over to see them as well. So I think it's a world's game, and a little bit like people that live in a village all their life, they know the gossip of everything in that village. Well, that's okay if you want to be like that, but You know, I don't just want to stay in the UK. It's always been my dream and aim to work outside. And at some point, either as a head of youth or a head coach, I need to take another opportunity to work outside the UK. That's my big passion, more so than it is chasing maybe what another coach wants at, in terms of maybe getting to the Premier League as a manager. My passion's always been to come and work outside.
You spoke about that, about being a head coach, and obviously there was a period of transition there, going from essentially first team coach to the managerial position. And evidently, you know, we reflect back upon it. Sao Paulo, Rangers, Aston Villa, you know, a lot of successful times, mainly spearheaded by the 2021 title tribe with Rangers in the SPL. But taking a QPR job, Michael, obviously there's an awful lot of, I suppose, inner work and reflection to do before taking possession of that. I mean, for you, I mean, when did you realise it was time to make the jump? How was that process transitioning from being a head coach to being the main guy as manager?
I thought when I come back from Brazil, I was ready, but then I had a chance to work with Stephen and Gary McAllister. And it was the best decision I ever made to work with those two men, because they gave me so much in terms of their experience as players, but also how they carry themselves as professionals. Like, in the period at Rangers, there were six or seven approaches at the time for me to go and be a manager, but nothing that I would leave Stephen and Gary for. We went to Aston Villa as a group as well. And the first period at Aston Villa was actually, if you looked at the league table from when they went into the end of the season, they would have been ninth in the league. It was actually good. And we got to the summer in quite a positive place. But then straight away, the season ended and I had two or three opportunities and I chose to go to QPR. Why QPR? Well, being from London, I hadn't been home in nearly 12 years since I'd moved away or 10 or 11 years since I'd moved away in 2012. I really got a good feeling about Les Ferdinand when I met him and the owners. I got a good feeling because Chris Ramsey was there running the academy, was someone that I'd known. And I knew what Loftus Road was. But the biggest reason was I watched QPR play quite a lot the year before because I quite liked the previous manager, Mark Warburton. But there was two players in the team, in Chris Willock and Ilias Chair, that I wanted to work with. And so I could really see myself coaching them because they were two mavericks that dribbled and outplayed. I knew maybe that wasn't enough in terms of the squad they had. How could I enhance that? Well, I didn't want to play with a back five. So quickly went and brought a young Dutch boy, Kenneth Powell, that I'd seen playing for PSV under-14s probably 8 years earlier. Managed to get him on a free transfer. And we brought Ethan Laird in from Man United. So now I had two fullbacks who could occupy the width to let Chris and Ilias go and play. And then you start looking at the middle of the team and think, well, we've got a couple of good centre-backs, but if we bring in Jake Clarke-Salt and Leon Balogun, we'll get stronger. They had Sam Field and Johansson, but then we brought Timo Robinham in, who's an outstanding talent from Aston Villa. And all of a sudden, I got this team that was looking like probably my under-14s team at Chelsea or my under-23s team at Liverpool that had nice structure, but had three or four players that had real freedom. And it was just a brilliant time, like a brilliant time. I knew from as soon as we went in at pre-season, I knew it was tough because the championships are win one, lose one, draw one league. And that gets you to the playoffs, by the way. It's that tough a league. And a lot of the teams are the same level. You know, like you have one player, it's a hot streak and it takes you on a little run. But that was the loudest changing room I've ever seen in that 4 months that I was there. Like, we'd be in the canteen and you could hear the players in the change room laughing and joking together. They were just in a fantastic place as a group. That was a pleasure to coach. But it first went back to when I watched the team, I was excited about Chris and Ilias. And then it was everything. How do I build around those two? How do I give them a strong midfield? How do I make people defend from that? So it was about how do I allow them to be free? And I've got to be honest, like, they were paid me in that period of time, they were paid me handsomely in some of the football and goals they scored. Like, it was a really, for my first experience as a manager, although it was only 21, 22 games, it was very short. The time that I had there and the friends that I've got there, it was a fantastic period.
It's interesting, though, to hear about you speaking about your time at QPR, how you were vindicated by having a principal that you've taken from youth development system as a coach in terms of the ability to outplay, the ability to have players to outplay 1v1, 2v1 when they're individual duels. Adhere to such a principle, be convinced by it, reap rewards back from it. I think it's, to be fair, it is quite an inspirational one, especially to hear many coaches that would be listening to this podcast in terms of over time. It's interesting how we can kind of adopt and we can adhere to other principles, but once you lose conviction in the very essence of the game that you got you into coaching, got you into playing, I think that's when you're on a downward trajectory.
Yeah, I think, look, you don't want to get eaten up by the game. It's important you stay fresh, you know, with the ideas that you have. It's important that you remind yourself of that. And I went, there was a lot of responsibility on one or two players there, Connor, because as soon as I went in, I spoke to Ilias Chair about what I wanted from him in terms of the freedom that I was going to give him, but the responsibility it took to make that style work every single day. So I put and responsibility on him to make sure that training was at the level that I wanted it to be at, because you know, and Chris, and there was times that I was really harsh on those two boys because I was, you know, it was a lot that I was putting to them. Same with Ethan and Kenneth in terms of what I wanted from them in terms of their energy as fullbacks, and at times that they would be a bit isolated because I was going to let and Chris cheat a little bit at times. And it come back to the ideas that I've had about football from 8 or 10 years before. You know, like, I was very privileged at Chelsea to work with some players and some age groups that played unbelievable football. My worry always was they'd probably play an unbelievable football without the need for a coach being there, because it didn't matter if it was me or the next age group coach, the next group, we always won. I learned a lot more about coaching when I went to Liverpool. Didn't have the same maybe strength in terms of volume. I still had some 5 or 6 in each age group that were top, but Chelsea, every player. But you're still trying to get back to play with that level of freedom that you had with those teams. And I wanted to do it at first team level. And I felt that after maybe a difficult 3 or 4 weeks at the start of the season, when at times we were a bit naive and open, once it really clicked and the players believed in it, they did the rest. And that team being at the top of the championship for a period of time was a fantastic journey. And again, it comes back to like that thing that we said about, like, are you willing to have one or two Mavericks that you know, you make allowances for your best players? And Ilias Chair and Chris repaid me handsomely in that period.
And it's a very interesting thought, but like, evidently, the past 6-7 months, it's probably been the longest self-enforced break you've had out of the game. Obviously, you're doing things still around the game and whatnot. But it's fair to say, I mean, your own journey has been really exponential. It's been on an upward trajectory for countless years. But there's been a lot that's happened in the last few years, especially transitioning from first team coach to manager. You know, not only at QPR, I've worked with big clubs such as Rangers and Sunderland too. I mean, how has the last 6 months been for yourself personally, just in terms of taking the time out to reflect on what has gone on in terms of what has been? And I mean, where and what areas have you kind of sunk to reflect a bit more deeper about yourself?
Well, the first thing is I'm not the same person I was when I was taking the move from Chelsea to Liverpool and I had a 6-month-old baby, and it was, I'm taking a big leap of faith in my future. Same when I left to go to Brazil, my children were 2 and 4, and now my children are a bit older and I've made some decisions. I'm very fortunate in my family life to have been a really lovely place with my wife and 3 children, but certainly I'm not the same person I was back then, you know, in terms of, I've got a lot more responsibility. So, you know, having this time at home with my kids and doing things with them that's really important and fundamental to them and their memories growing up is important. And maybe those things were a miss to me for a period of time because you're so obsessed with the game. How can I put it? I've always wanted to be a head coach, and I've been given an opportunity in 3 huge clubs, you know, QPR, sells out every week in London. As I say, it's a big club. It's been a Premier League club. It's got a big tradition. Rangers speaks for itself in terms of 50,000 every week and the demands. And then Sunderland, 44,000. So I realise I've been given opportunities based off a lot of hard work that not a normal person gets given. I try to stay true to my beliefs in all 3 clubs. And it comes at you quite fast. I was expecting to stay at QPR to learn my craft a lot longer than what I did. And after a short period of time, there was a big publicised thing about a Premier League club coming in. I wanted to stay at QPR at the time. Then Rangers come. My family was moving back to Glasgow anyway because the kids didn't settle in the Midlands. So there was a lot around it. And the QPR, the Rangers team, I'd been through a massive journey with, as you say, for 3.5 years. A lot of that squad was still there. And so I chose to come back, and it was a huge privilege to come back. I think to win 73% of your games and be deemed a failure, football's mad in that sense. There were some bits I could have done better. Certainly in the summer of last year, we lost the sporting director, which was a big loss to me because I'm not sure if I'd have took the job without the sporting director and the CEO that were in place, because I knew them and I felt comfortable and safe managing a club of that size with those people in place, because they knew me, they knew the areas that I needed support. When they both left between April and May, then it put a lot of strain on me. But the biggest issue was I was trying to build a team around Cantwell, Kent and Tillman, and I lost two of the three pieces, and then you're trying to replace. But listen, it's life. I was disappointed it didn't work at Rangers because it meant a lot to me, and it's a high-profile job. I still took enough from the win percentage in the first period of time that I had there to know that a lot of my ideas were working. I needed to tweak a few things with staff. And probably off the back of that, I took the Sunderland job because it's a massive job. Who wouldn't take it? It's a wonderful club. But I took it at a time where maybe I wanted to get back in more than what I needed to. So I've had to learn from that. In terms of the day-to-day coaching every day, I'm still proud of the work that I've done in all three clubs. I know that the work is good because the feedback given from the players and was always really positive. I've stayed true to my beliefs. But in this time that you're out, of course, you go over everything with a fine-tooth comb to really look at the areas that I can improve and evolve from being a coach, if you like, to being a manager. And I think that certainly in the latter period at Rangers, I was a manager more than I was a coach. And I don't think that was beneficial to me or the team because, you know, with the sporting director and the CEO leaving and new people coming in, but maybe they were learning on the job as well. It wasn't easy. The period at Sunderland's the one real big disappointing period of my career, because I went in on my own to work with their staff, and it was quite clear early on that the fans didn't want the change. And it was quite clear early on that I felt I needed some support of people that knew me around me. So look, there's no qualms in leaving after the period there. Again, that was very similar when I looked at that team. They had Patrick Roberts and Jack Clark, and that was very, very similar to the idea when I went into QPR. We lost Pat in the second game, and the team is a very talented team, but very young. The biggest reflection I've done is that I fouled. That's the biggest reflection. It's not looking outwards at what could have, should have. Give you a rough idea there, Connor, of some of the things that was happening in the club. But in my feeling that I could have done better. So that's me being back now while I'm out, making sure that when I get the next opportunity, wherever that is, and I would like it to be outside the UK if possible. So that's what I'm looking at, to go and have a big experience outside. But I'm certainly looking at what I could have done better rather than looking for excuses. That's always been my way. And I think what I would say is all three opportunities that I've had, they've been massive opportunities. You know, the clubs are absolutely fantastic. And for whatever reason, certainly at Sunderland, it didn't work. You know, that's something that I'll have to grow from. There's no hiding away from that.
And as you eloquently said, I mean, right now it does mark a new chapter in your own illustrious journey. I mean, you have come on this podcast today as someone who seems refreshed and rejuvenated and ready to go again. Just curious to learn a bit more as to, you know, within the last 6 months, you spoke about visits to Brazil, you spoke about studying the Japanese youth development system at the moment. I mean, could be from within football, could be outside of football, but from where and from who are you taking inspiration on your own learning journey right now?
Just speaking to a lot of people that are involved in the game, you realize like I'd speak to a manager in League Two in England, they got the same issues to there's a manager that I've coached against in the Europa League or know that's managing the Champions League team. It's just different levels, you know. We're all talking about managing people and transfer budgets and the support that we get around it. I've got every session plan since like 2004, mate, like every single one. So I'm going through all of the work and trying to break that and something smaller, something that I can hand over a little bit to my coaching staff at times so they can lead on some areas more as well. So I've always been someone that don't believe in Superman coaches, that you need three or four other hands on the pitch for variety and different voices. But I want to take that to another level as well. We work with a model that, you know, I have unit coaches or low lieutenants, if you like. So I have someone look after the goalkeepers, natural, but defenders, midfield, forwards, and I sit above it. Is that right? Is it wrong? Do I want to tinker with it a little bit? The use of set play coaches now, the importance of that, how the individual development, this you versus yourself model, how it all fits. Languages is big, so I'm back working on my Spanish and Portuguese to make sure I maintain those. I always come back to youth development. It's crazy, really. Like, I always want to talk to your Alex Inglethorpes and your people that are working in youth development, because I think that's they're seeing where the game's going. I find sometimes at first senior level, people are so engrossed in the now. There's so much to manage now. And youth development's always my passion. I will go back to it at some stage. And as I say, yeah. Now, anything anywhere in the world, all around the world, mate.
It's a really interesting thought, too. You know, being privy to all these conversations with your Alex Inglethorpes and whatnot, seeing where the game is going. For someone that's been in first team coaching, you know, for the last 7, 8 years, I mean, if you were to shave 20 years off yourself, Michael, and be back in the academy working as a coach, working all the way up again, what would be the key areas that you'd work on in the coming 5 to 10 years when it comes to player development?
I think as a coach, how do you keep yourself energized? I think that's important. Like, you know, the energy that you had as a younger coach, you need to keep that all the way through with more pressure and more scrutiny. How do you keep yourself energized? That's a really important conversation that what I think the best coaches are able to do. And then with young players, it's like, how can you make hard drive, the work from 9 to 12 on their releasing, receiving the ball, the way that they move with it, the way they release it, that's like a hard drive. After that, it's right, what's your playing philosophy? What is your self-awareness? Like, where are you going? What is it makes you the player you are? What's your daily rituals? How can we make young players have a real strong identity? How can we make young players not be scared of telling us what their strengths are? So if a young player in your club kind of comes past you and you say, go on, what makes you the player you are? A lot of young kids find it really hard to say that. And they should say, I'm a goal scorer, goal creator, I work hard, I've got a really good left foot, or I'm really good at this, I'm working on this, this, and this. I think we need to make players much more self-aware and confident in expressing themselves. And I think that's it. I think football comes down to relationships and feelings. So the relationship you have with staff and your teammates, the feeling that gives you, but also the relationship in terms of the way your team plays football and the feeling that gives you inside. So relationship and feelings are really, really important thing. And as I say, like, we've got to make sure, and I'm one that's been preaching that for a long time, and I feel that I did it more than most, is let the ball roll. Like, let the players play, even at first team level. When they come to train every day and it's 10:30 or 11, they want to play football. You feel they need to work on X, Y, and Z. The job is trying to mold the two. And I think, you know, some coaches are very standoffish, and maybe as I become more a manager, I have to learn to create a barrier between me and the players. But my natural default setting is to be close, and I won't change that because, as I say, the relationships. And even if I go back to this last period at Rangers and working with players like Malik Tillman and Todd Cantwell, like having a coffee with them outside the club and listening to their ambition, listening to what's going on in their family and learning about them. Jack Butland when we were signing. We had two or three meetings where we just spoke about things that didn't really have to do with football. As I say, it comes down to relationship and feeling, and you have to want to go on a journey with someone. That's what I miss from youth development, going on the journeys. At first team football, you're there for a period of time. You would love to be in a club for a long period where you could go on those journeys the same. But the bit that I've loved about the journey of being a coach that come from the age group is the journey. And I see Mason Mount recently because his dad invited me to the Man United Liverpool game, and I hadn't seen him in a number of years. And I'm very proud to see the journey that he's gone on. Like, it makes me old that now he's in his mid-20s, because you remember the 6 or 7 year old that come in, and just talking to him, you realize everything from the outside is perfect, but everything that's going on in life is, you know, for each of these young kids, Declan, you know, Trent Alexander, Curtis Jones, all these young players, but you're so proud of the journey they've gone on, you know. So the journeys are important in football, I think. And again, it comes back to relationship and feeling. And if you get that right, then obviously, I think that all the young coaches now, don't be in too much of a rush, because when you get there, you have to be good enough. You'd hate to foul your players because you're not competent enough. I think that's a message I would send to my younger self.
Absolutely fantastic insights and plenty of gold here for any coaches to glean, Michael, in the last hour. But I have to thank you profoundly as well for spending your afternoon here on the podcast, because it's been one in which I've been very much looking forward to doing for a while. You're a huge inspiration of mine. So thank you for coming on today.
No, I appreciate it. Thanks, Connor.